Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will likely be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. I just wonder if the day will ever come when you're merely fantastic. But
you know, yeah, if I've had a serious accident or, you know, a big financial loss or something, that might cut me down to just super or just fantastic. But
okay.
Heaven forbid, right? Yeah.
Right.
You know what? You know what I always say, that I'm day job, I'm in marketing, so I feel like that's the kind of answer you got to give, right? You know,
that's
you know, you want to have that proper spin on how you're doing. So, and not only am I doing super fantastic, but the show is too, because we're just kicking off tonight a special three-part series on the new economy, and this is going to be loads of fun. We've got a terrific guest tonight, and we'll be talking with another very exciting guest next week. So, I think, why don't we just jump right into it?
That sounds great. Let's do it.
All right. Well, very pleased to welcome our guest. Martin Ford is the founder of a Silicon Valley-based software development firm. He has over 25 years of experience in the fields of computer design and software development. He holds a computer engineering degree from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, and he's a graduate business degree from the University of California, Los Angeles. Martin, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Thanks for having me on, Phil.
Well, it's great to have you. Stephen and I have been talking about your book, The Lights in the Tunnel, for, I don't know, 2 or 3 months. I think it seems like I got a copy back in December, and we've been planning to put this series together for quite some time. So I'm glad we finally got the logistics worked out, and it's terrific to have you on the program. We'll be getting into talking about The Lights in the Tunnel as we proceed through the evening. But I think before we delve into the book, maybe we want to set some groundwork and just talk a little bit about what you see happening in the economy generally, and I don't mean like this week, but as far as the trends. And on our site, we had a list of current trends that you hear a lot about: globalization and collaboration and telecommuting. And the question actually that I lifted off your site was, are these the forces that are going to shape the workplaces of the future, or is there something bigger lurking? So how about we start off with that kind of loaded question?
Right. I think that those forces are certainly important, but I think that the impact of technology and technological acceleration just sort of gets underestimated. I think people don't realize what a dramatic impact it's going to have, perhaps because to a certain extent we've grown used to it, and it's sort of been shoved into the background. It's something that we all take for granted. But I think that right now there's a tremendous focus on globalization and on collaboration, the things that technologies enable among people, but there's very little focus on the technology itself. And what I think is the reality, which is that in terms of the job market, the technology itself is really going to become the primary competitor that workers are going to face. And so I think, honestly, that the biggest thing that's going to happen in the economy over the next 10, 20, 30 years, and I'm not really sure, you know, what the period is going to be, but I think that the biggest thing that's going to happen is that we're going to see an acceleration in job automation technology. We're going to see essentially machines, software algorithms, artificial intelligence algorithms, these types of things begin to be able to do jobs of all kinds. And that is something that I think most people just haven't really thought through the implications of that. I mean, it's going to have a dramatic impact not just on the economy, but on society, on democracy, on everything. I think it's something that's going to be a huge trend, which just right now is widely unacknowledged. And so I think
Martin,
that'd be the biggest thing.
Could you kind of walk us through your thought experiment that's the basis of your book, Lights in the Tunnel?
Right. I use in the book what you might think of as kind of a mental simulation or a way to visualize it. And basically what I do is I set up an imaginary tunnel, and it's just you can think of an infinitely long tunnel. And within that tunnel are lights, millions and millions, or in fact billions of lights. And each of those lights represents a consumer, which and what I'm really focusing on in the book is the mass market economy, which is, in other words, the economy of the developed world, you know, the economy of countries like the United States and Europe and developing countries like China. So you've got roughly a billion people there, maybe 20% of the world's population. And that's really the major world economy. That's what drives everything. And that economy is comprised of individuals, and those individuals all have purchasing power. And they go out and they basically buy things, and that's ultimately what drives the entire economy. So I set up a simulation where each of those people is represented by a light, and then on the sides of the tunnel are all the businesses, the entities that are basically selling products and services to those people. And then having set up that simulation, what I do is I look at what would happen if essentially those lights start to disappear, and the way they're going to disappear is you know, they're not going to have an income anymore because there's going to be a machine or a software algorithm doing the job that gives that individual an income. And over time, as that progresses relentlessly, what you see is that, you know, you simply don't have enough lights in the tunnel, or you don't have enough consumers in the market who actually have access to an income that gives them sufficient purchasing power or discretionary income to go out and buy things. And we have to remember that in terms of really driving the economy, you know, in the developed world, it's not about people having enough to survive and just buy essentials. It's really about people having discretionary income, having income above and beyond what they need to survive, so that they can go out and buy cars and Apple iPods and all the kinds of things that really drive the economy at the margin. Right? That's where the real success comes from. That's what makes us wealthy. It's not selling, you know, substance goods to people. It's selling discretionary goods to people. And in reality, you have to have enough of those people to support a mass market economy. And if anyone doubts that, they can just take a look at what's happening out there right now. Look at what happened to the auto industry last year. When you don't have enough people with income and perhaps even as important with confidence in the future so that they're willing to spend that income, then, you know, you're not going to have a successful economy, certainly not selling discretionary products.
Yeah, it's interesting when you put it that way. You think about unemployment being hovering around double digits here for the last, year or so. And prior to that, we had been through a period where it was considered fairly high if it got up to 5. So up to 5%. So suddenly you have twice as many people out of work and probably 5 times as many people worried that they're going to lose their jobs. What does that do to consumer activity? It's got to have a disastrously dampening effect on that activity when people are scared. I mean, and of course that becomes kind of a cycle in its own right. Although that's that's in the shorter term, that production would be cut and so forth. But if you look over the longer term, where ultimately we expect the economy to continue to grow and automation to continue to occur. You know what's interesting about that is I can remember when someone would pump your gas for you, right?
Right.
I've been in the corporate world long enough that when I started out doing business travel, we actually used a travel agent, right? There was like a human being that you would call and talk to about these things. I go to the grocery store now, and I never go to a human checkout line, right? I always go through the self-scan line. You know, I always make sure I've got just enough items so I can go through the self-scan line. And you think about how many occupations, if you just kind of reflect, we've seen disappear due to automation. Over, you know, really just the last few decades. Some of it because the job was eliminated, and oftentimes just because of convenience, we often choose the automated version. I choose the automated checkout line. I'll go to an ATM above going to the bank just about any time, right?
Right, right.
And, you know, that's a teller whose job has, to some extent, been compromised, if not lost because of that. So let's wind it back just for a minute, because one of the things that is interesting about the lights in the tunnel metaphor, the analogy, is that if you look at the world as a whole, right, if the tunnel we're looking at is not just the U.S. economy, but the whole world economy.
Right, that's very important, right.
To date, there have always been more lights than before, right, for any period of time, right,
for
any given period of time. And
Because there are more lights pouring into the tunnel, that's one of the things that I mentioned, right, because you have, you know, people in poor countries getting wealthier and being able to enter that tunnel or enter the marketplace, right?
Yeah, exactly. In fact, one of the things we often talk about is how over the last just two or three decades, more people have been lifted out of poverty than in all of human history prior to that. So there's been a mass increase in the number of consumers. Now, does that growth not offset the loss that would be experienced elsewhere?
What I think is that it offsets it in the short run, but you have to really think about it carefully and recognize what's really happening. One thing that's going on is a whole bunch of those people are in China, or countries like China, and, you know, China is, those people are deriving their incomes essentially from two places. One is that they're exporting to the developed nations, and the other one is that the Chinese government is investing, right, in the economy. You know, there's tremendous investment happening in the Chinese economy. But very little of it, only about a third of it, is coming from things actually being sold in that country. So what that means is that the overall economy is still being driven in terms of consumer spending by the U.S. and by the developed countries. And the question you have to ask is that sustainable? You can't, you know, everything that you produce in the economy, every good, every service, ultimately has to be purchased by someone. You know, someone has to go out and buy it. And right now, that's happening in the U.S. and in the European countries and places like that. Unless the Chinese can make their economy more self-sustaining by raising their consumer spending locally, you know, it's very difficult to see how that can continue forever. That's one important thing. And the second very, very important thing that people, I think, don't recognize too much is that this automation process is not something that's just happening in the United States. It's happening in China as well. I mean, China has lost millions of jobs in industries like textiles because technology is improving and because companies like Walmart put tremendous pressure on suppliers in China to continue to cut costs, and in order to do that, they bring in better technology, they bring in automation. So even in countries where you've got workers, you know, who are willing to work for a dollar an hour or less, those workers ultimately can't compete with machines. So this process is going to happen not just in the U.S., but it's going to happen ultimately in the third world countries as well. And if you really look far into the future, and some of the things I'm sure you talk, you know, at other times about these shows, things like nanotechnology, advanced nanotechnology. If you look, you know, decades ahead, technologies like that are going to have to be near fully automated. I mean, what possible role would a low-wage worker have in a process that is, you know, dominated by nanotechnology? I mean, they're really not going to be a place for them at all. So if you look far enough ahead, you can see that, that across the board, you're going to see technology taking jobs. And when you view it as just one economy, one world economy, you can see that the lights everywhere are essentially going to start to flicker out. You know, people everywhere are simply not going to have an income if they don't have a job.
I note that Sally in the chat room says, part of globalization, Mexican workers complaining of losing their jobs to Asia. And in fact, I've seen statistics on that where American workers have complained about jobs that were lost to Mexico, but Mexico had lost some to China. And then, as you point out, even in Asia, jobs are lost to automation there.
But you know, that's the really important point, though, is that you've got people in the U.S. complaining that the Chinese or the Mexicans are stealing the jobs, and the Mexicans may be saying the Chinese are stealing. But there's always this focus on other people taking our jobs. But the reality is you ask economists that really study this, and they'll tell you that although, yes, jobs have been lost to other, you know, to globalization, more jobs have been eliminated everywhere through automation. So automation is a bigger thing, that it's eliminating more jobs than jobs being, you know, moved to other countries. And this is ongoing all the time, but we don't see it. It's not as visible, and it's not it's much easier to point the finger at other people than at this somewhat invisible process that is going on all the time, and of course has been going on for decades.
I wonder if we'll see some of these jobs. I wonder if we'll see some of these jobs that have gone overseas and now are automated overseas. Well, if they can be automated overseas, why aren't they automated closer to the consumers in the United States? In other words, if you're Walmart, couldn't you, say, well, they're we're getting these cheap textiles from China. Let's use the same machines here, and we can cut out the cost of shipping them.
Right. And I think that's exactly right. And in fact, that's one of the important points I make in the book, is that as labor costs drop to zero, other costs become more important, and probably the most important one, especially if you believe that in the future energy is going to become more and more expensive. Transportation costs is going to be one of the biggest things. So there is certainly reason to believe that in the future we may be looking at more of a distributed manufacturing model, where instead of focusing all the manufacturing in low-wage countries the way it is today, you're going to distribute it and put it closer either to the end consumer or to, the raw materials, so that logistically you cut down on the shipping costs. I think you may also see factories that are a lot more flexible. If you've got factories that are highly automated, you may be able to build much smaller factories that can build a variety of products, and you put them in close proximity to consumers.
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say one thing that to a certain extent is going to counteract that, and this is something that's been pointed out, is that countries like China, they attract industry and jobs not just by offering low wages, but by other things too. They've got an industrial policy. They offer tax advantages. They offer very lenient environmental type safeguards and that kind of thing, right? So that also is a role that would tend to counteract that. But still, I think in the long run, you're definitely going to see a reversal of globalization if this trend continues.
I wonder if the reason it hasn't happened to date is that as automated as most of those factories are, there still are some people working there, and it would be an investment, of course, to recreate the infrastructure back in the U.S., and also, of course, it would be you'd be paying the higher wages to the American workers. So it just, by and large, hasn't been a big value proposition. But that's subject to change once the infrastructure has to be swapped out anyway, and once it becomes more highly automated.
Right, right. I mean, it depends on the exact trade-off within the industry and how in the future, I think you're going to see factories that are almost entirely automated. So the labor is essentially going to be zero. Once it starts to get to that point, the motivations to move it, to China or another country like that, and then pay the shipping costs is going to certainly be a lot less.
So when do we see a inflection point? When, because I don't have statistics, but my guess would be we're still in a globally net positive job creating situation, that I think that probably there are still more people getting work than had in the past. When does that start to reverse in your view?
I don't have a specific date for that, and I don't know. You know, we may be, I think, right, it's possible that we're right on top of that inflection point now. I mean, with what's happening now. I mean, it's very hard to get data for the whole world in terms of
global employment
creation. I mean, statistics coming out of China in particular are always suspect. You never really know what's going on there. I mean, they could at any moment have mass unemployment, and they could have civil unrest there, and we probably wouldn't have much advance notice of it. Here, obviously, things are very difficult, and everyone is projecting that it's going to remain very difficult for years. I've heard projections it's going to be 5 years, 7 years before the labor market here snaps back. And the thing that I would point out with that is that during those years, while we're waiting for the labor market here to recover, technology continues to advance. So it's really a moving target. It gets harder and harder to have employment return to where it was, because technology gets better all the time. And you keep hearing stories in the press of companies that are eliminating workers through technology. There was just a story about UPS, for instance, eliminating over 1,000 white-collar workers, basically because they've got better computer systems, and they're just able to get rid of those people. They don't need them anymore. And you're going to see.
So it's not just people on the factory floor. It's also mental workers as well, isn't it?
That's right, and that's one of the most important points that I try to make in my book, is that, I mean, most people, I think, would buy into this idea to a certain extent. Everyone understands that technology is getting better, and especially in factories, automation is progressing, jobs are getting eliminated. But there's still this perception that it's basically something that primarily affects people who have relatively few skills or are not all that educated. And I think that's totally wrong. I think that has been true so far because, technology hasn't quite reached the point yet where it's able to impact workers with higher skill levels. But I think that we're certainly on a threshold, if we haven't crossed already, the point where that is going to change. You see all kinds of stuff in the press now about software automation coming online, people who are sitting in cubicles, doing essentially routine knowledge worker type jobs are already highly subject to offshoring, of course. And I think in the very near future, you're going to see a lot of software automation, artificial intelligence type algorithms that can do a lot of their jobs too. So one of the things that concerns me the most is that I think most people believe that the answer to all this is that, we need more training, more education. We need to prepare people for the jobs of the future, right? You keep hearing that, sort of a cliche. And I think that's fine, that's a good thing, but I'm very, very doubtful that we can outrun technology by retraining everyone. First of all, most people, or a very large number of people, simply aren't going to be capable of receiving that training and putting it to use. And even those people who do go out and get degrees, in various areas, it's not clear that the jobs are ultimately going to be there. I mean, we can't all be nurses. We can't all work in healthcare.
I'm not even sure the nurses' jobs are going to be safe at some point.
I mean, the conventional wisdom is that, people are going to migrate into areas that require creativity, that require some sort of uniquely human talent, something that can't be replicated by a machine. And I think it's reasonable to say that there always will be jobs like that, yes. There will be some jobs, but we've got a workforce now of 140 million people about in the United States, only about 130 million of which are working. I mean, that's a lot of people. We can't put all those people, and that number keeps getting bigger, every year. How are we going to fit all those people into, creative, human-type jobs that aren't repetitive or routine in nature? because any job that is basically repetitive, whether it's working in a factory or it's working in an office, someday a machine is going to be able to do that. I believe that.
Here are a couple questions from our chat room. The first one is, won't the system just naturally balance itself out? This is from Ken.
Well, the problem with that is that the way the system naturally balances itself out is going to be some sort of a massive depression. I mean, as you reach a point where more and more people lose their jobs, then consumer confidence falls, consumer spending falls, and then you get into a downward spiral. It will essentially balance itself out, but it will make us all poorer in doing so. I mean, once technology enables a business, an individual business, to automate and save money, and become more profitable, then from the perception of that business, there isn't any incentive not to do it. In fact, there's every incentive to do it, and in fact, they have to do it because their competitors are doing it. They don't have an alternative. If you're Walmart and you're competing with Target, and Target brings in automation and robots and cuts their costs and therefore drops their prices, then Walmart has to do it too, whether they want to or not. And as you eliminate more and more jobs, you eliminate more and more consumers. So there's a spiral there. So, I mean, I guess that's a balancing, but how – I don't really see how it's
not a very
way to create jobs.
Not a good end for the balancing, that's for sure. How about this question from Harvey? Will we still need a military defense?
Would we still need our military defense? I presume so. I mean, I think that this entire phenomenon, if we're talking about economic stagnation, maybe even decline in the long term, I mean, that can only make the world less safe. I mean, it can only lead to more conflict.
I think Harvey's question is, will we still need humans in the military? Will those jobs be safe?
There's a lot of talk in the Pentagon. There's a book written recently called Wired for War. It's been a pretty popular book that talks about this. But there's no doubt that the military is investing in robotics. And so we could very well see, robotic armies in the future. We've already got, of course, the Predator drones up there, right? And those, in fact, are becoming more and more autonomous. So I think there will be places, for human soldiers, but it may well become more automated in the future as well, which is something that always strikes me, because you've got people in the Pentagon, in the military establishment, that see this very clearly, and they're planning for it. They're planning for this evolution. But then in the civilian sector, you seem not to have the same people looking at these same technologies and saying, look, if you can build robots that are going to be autonomous on a battlefield, then can't you also build a robot that can work in a warehouse? I mean, it seems like technically that's a much lower challenge, isn't it?
Right.
So, I mean, experts agree it's happening on the military front, so it's going to happen in the civilian front as well, for sure.
Martin, I'm buying all the arguments that you make in the first half of the book. You need both a supply and a demand side to the economy. They feed off of each other, and without one, you can't have the other. I also buy that automation is going to reduce all kinds of jobs. There's not just factory jobs, but mental work as well. And so, I guess my next question is, so what's the answer? What would you propose that be done as these lights begin to flicker out?
Right. And let me say what you're sort of driving at here is something I get all the time. It's, basically people tend to divide the book into two halves, and they say, yeah, the first half of the book, it all makes sense. I see that. And then the second half of the book, where I start proposing some things we might do, they totally freak out. They say, oh, And that's very common, and I share that, to be honest with you. I'm not, I'm someone that runs a small business. Okay, I believe in our system, our capitalist system. I'd be very happy if the system we have now could continue forever without any changes, because I've done okay with it. I'm comfortable with it. But I honestly don't think that's a viable alternative. I think we're going to have to make some structural changes. I believe that we're going to have to find some mechanism to get purchasing power into the hands of consumers. And historically, that has been jobs. And that has been jobs because work by people has been indispensable. Today and at every time up until today, you couldn't have an economy at all if you didn't have people working, and you needed to give those people an incentive to work hard at whatever type of job they were doing. And that's why the system has worked. But what's going to happen when that's no longer the case? When essentially we've got massive numbers of people, perhaps a huge percentage of the population that's essentially disenfranchised, that basically they are no longer essential to the economy. And, as a result of that, they don't have a traditional income. Now, what we have to recognize is if you really acknowledge that the first half of the book is true, then it's not just that we're going to have a massive number of people in that situation, but it's the case that because technology will never stop advancing, it's going to become a larger and larger share of the population over time. And if you go far enough into the future, 100 years from now, 200 years from now, whatever you want to imagine, when we have, technologies that are presumably unimaginable, then it could be virtually everyone. I mean, where does it stop? It doesn't stop. I mean, there's really no way to outrun it. So the only thing I can envision is that you have to have the government step in and provide an alternate mechanism for getting purchasing power into the hands of consumers so that they can then go out and buy stuff. And the central idea that I make in the second half of the book is that right now we value people as producers. We value people for what they can produce, what work they can do, what they can contribute directly to producing things in the economy. I honestly believe that there is a point in the future where maybe we have to take a different view and we have to value people as consumers. We have to value them primarily as their role as consumers. Because everyone, of course, has got a dual role. Everyone is both a producer and a consumer. But in the future, we're going to have to recognize that consumption by people is going to be, if we're not going to jump into some really, really wild science fiction scenario where machines are doing end consumption, right, where machines are going out and buying stuff, if we're going to accept that people are going to continue to do that, and we need a critical mass of people that are going to continue to do that, we've got to find a way to get money into their hands. I mean, if it's not going to be a job, it's got to be something else. And if you think about the economy in an abstract way, like in terms of a computer simulation, like I did with the lights in the tunnel, then it really doesn't matter how you get the money into the hands of the people so that they can go out and buy stuff. It doesn't matter whether they're actually doing a job or not, if that job is not required in order to produce things in the economy. What is required is that they have to have both confidence and income so that they can go out and buy things. Without that, you don't have an economy. You don't have one.
So let's look at this. The principal means of putting spending power into the hands of consumers would be, just to use a really loaded term, welfare checks. Is that right? There would be disbursements from a central government authority paying people so that they would become consumers, which would require that this government would be taxing the highly automated businesses at a, I would think, substantial. Well, and I know from reading the book actually a substantially high rate in order to enable the payment to the population at large to keep the consumption going. And of course, the businesses would have to be on board with that because they recognize at that point that they need the consumers to be purchasing their goods and services.
That's right. I mean, let's acknowledge that it's a little bit too – it's hard to visualize how these businesses suddenly getting on board with this idea and saying, oh, yeah, that's great, at this point. But, that's the scheme that I foresee in the future. I don't know how else to do it. I mean, you've got to get the income from somewhere. And one thing you can say very, very clearly is that we're already talking a lot about income inequality and concentration of income in this country. As the income is becoming more and more concentrated into a few people at the top. And that's a trend I believe will continue. And I believe that the primary thing that's driving that is technology. It's globalization too, and it's a lot of other things. But ultimately, it's going to be advancing technology and it's going to be the idea that we no longer value individual work on the part of people in the way that we once did. That's going to, you know, essentially concentrate all the income into the hands of just a few people. Now, those people obviously are going to fight to keep it that way until they realize that essentially there's going to be no one out there to buy anything. And, you know, once you get into that scenario, then you're looking at a downward spiral. So I think that's the only solution, is to basically tax the few people that are earning very high incomes and then get it back into the hands of consumers. There are lots of different scenarios. I think it could partly be a consumption tax. It could be a tax on very high-income people. It could be business taxes. You know, that's something that would have to be worked out. But it absolutely has to be a system of taxation and redistribution, and those are loaded words. I mean, it sounds like socialism, I understand, but ultimately I think it's going to have to be necessary in order to save capitalism, because you can't have capitalism without consumers. Someone has to buy the things that are being produced.
Martin, let's imagine for a moment I'm a CEO of, I don't know, some company that produces widgets. The reason I would move to automation is not because I hate my workers. It's because I can see that I can make more widgets cheaper with these robots than I can with the people I have working down in my factory now.
Right.
And so I end up producing more widgets. So in a way, there is more wealth being produced in the world because I make that change. There's more of these things that apparently somebody wants being produced. So that is a good thing. I guess the whole point of it is that this wealth is being produced for the good of someone. And I guess what you're saying is that this has the tendency of concentrating the wealth in a small number of people. I guess in this case it'd be the stockholders of my company. Is that right?
Yes, although, you know, in terms of stockholders and companies, I mean, I think there's a lot of evidence to show that the main, you know, stockholders of companies are largely things like pension plans and 401k plans, and you know, they're not doing all that well right now. The primary beneficiaries are, I think, very wealthy people who own lots of stock in the company and the management of the company. I mean, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the companies are being largely run nowadays for the benefit of their management. Certainly that's true on Wall Street. So, you know, this idea that the company's going to become more profitable and the stock's going to soar and all the stockholders are going to be dramatically better off, I'm not sure I really buy into that. But the point is that there's got to be someone out there that's going to buy the widgets. You know, and if everyone's losing their job, then who's going to, you know, who's going to be there to buy the widgets?
What if instead of having like a system where the government redistributes, what if we just had a system where a higher percentage of the population owns stock in all these companies? And basically we're all living on dividends, and we're taking our dividends and we're turning around and buying the widgets.
Yeah, I mean, that's something.
Could you rebalance like that?
I've seen that idea proposed. So how do we redistribute ownership in all these companies? Because right now there are a whole bunch of people out there who don't earn anything, right?
Yeah.
And
right.
The people that do own something, they, you know, it's generally through their retirement program. And we keep hearing that people don't even have enough money, not even close to having enough money to retire. But now you're saying somehow we're going to get from this point to the point where people are getting dividend income that's so high, not only can they retire, but they can support themselves throughout their life. I mean, I don't see how we really get there. It's kind of what you're proposing is a bit of a bubble almost. It's like we all believe that, okay, automation is going to drive down costs and make everything more productive, and so stocks will soar and, you know, dividends will go up, and then so we believe that, and that will make it happen, and then everyone will take the income that they get from that and go out and buy stuff and actually drive the economy. It doesn't sound doable to me. Although I've actually, I'm on my blog, which is at econfuture.wordpress.com. There's a posting on this. There's an economist named Robin Hanson at George Mason University. He actually wrote an academic paper on the economic impact of real machine intelligence, like if we really had, you know, genuinely intelligent machines. And basically what he said is exactly what you're saying. He said that the whole economy would just grow exponentially, and you know, if you owned anything, even a tiny little sliver of this thing, you'd have so much income that you'd be fine. You wouldn't have to worry. To me, it doesn't seem workable.
Should point out that Robin has been a guest on the program, although we didn't get into that particular topic when we had him on. Well, it seems to me that to implement either system, either what you're describing, Martin, or what Stephen is talking about, there would have to be large structural changes that would have to be put in place, and new ideas are going to have to be introduced that are going to be not well received by an awful lot of the status quo. Is it fair to say that?
Oh, that's obvious. Yeah, I mean, it's the things I'm talking about. I mean, you know, anyone who's economically conservative is going to be repelled by them. And as I said, you know, I myself am not entirely comfortable with these ideas either. But having thought it through, I really don't see an alternative. I mean, you people are going to have an income, you know. And I'm, you know, the thing is, I look at things just economically. I'm just thinking, if you've got consumers with no money to spend, then you know they're not going to buy anything, and so you're not going to have an economy. But of course, you can't divorce that from politics, right? I mean, it's not sustainable. At some point, as income becomes too concentrated, there's going to be a tipping point, right, where massive numbers of people are essentially disenfranchised. I mean, they're going to rise up and they're going to demand some political change. And so I guess that's the point at which you're going to begin to see these things. The problem is that, you know, what I'm trying to propose is an idea that can essentially keep the system that we have, modify the system we have. But I honestly think that there's a real danger that if things get out of control, politically, socially, you know, we could see something even more draconian. I mean, we could see a real, people will call this socialism, but I don't think it is. I mean, we could see something like a real communist revolution at some point.
Well, now the S word has shown up in the chat room here, and it's being thrown about. They're going into a feeding frenzy. So I know you stated your capitalist bona fides earlier, but let's reiterate this. You don't consider this what you're describing to be socialism, is that right?
I don't, but I understand what people would call it. That I mean, it's certainly not pure capitalism either. But the point I'm making is that I'm saying that pure capitalism, as we understand it today, you know, as Ayn Rand would define it, is not going to be sustainable. It's not going to work because the technology is going to make it impossible. And the people that are in denial about that are probably people who either are already, you know, independently wealthy in some sense, or they're very sure that their job isn't going to get automated. But ultimately, there's going to come a tipping point where you know, almost everyone is going to be vulnerable to this, and the system is simply not going to be sustainable.
Now, one of the ideas that we talk about frequently on this program, probably one of our most visited ideas, is has to do with economic growth. Some of the ideas that Robin Hanson does deal with, and the notion of there being tremendous material abundance in the future due to automation, and thanks to technology such as artificial intelligence and nanotechnology. People having increasing control over their own ability to manipulate the material world to produce goods themselves, essentially kind of since we're on to socialism now, the Marxist ideal of the means of production passing into the hands of the workers, ultimately happening in the form of everyone being able to produce whatever it is they need. If you achieve that level, if technology takes us to that point and economic development takes us to that point, do we need lights in the tunnel? Do we need a consumer economy at that point?
Here's the point I would make about this. Whenever people discuss this, and very often it gets discussed in conjunction with nanotechnology and the idea that if you take it to the extreme, we're going to have something like the materializer on Star Trek, right? That can just basically create anything out of nothing.
On this show, we call those sandwich printers, by the way.
Right, okay.
Printers that will make your sandwich.
Right. Look at it in terms of your budget today, in terms of an average consumer, because we're always thinking in terms of widgets being produced. How much do you spend on widgets? Okay, where is your income going if you're an average person in the United States? Most of it is going for housing, is going for healthcare, transportation, right? So if we reach a point where all kinds of things can be, produced at essentially no cost, what impact does that really have? Okay, basically what you're talking about is everything at Walmart becomes free, okay, essentially free, and so you can go to Walmart and get as much as you want for basically nothing. But what about all your other expenses? What about housing? These technologies would make it less expensive to build houses, presumably, but it wouldn't change.
They won't create any land, right? Nor will they hand out land, right?
It won't create land.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that we need to understand that the costs that the consumer faces in terms of housing and healthcare are relatively rigid, okay? If you've got a mortgage, then automation is not going to lower your mortgage. I mean, it might lower interest rates potentially somewhat, and you can refinance, but I mean, interest rates are right now very low. I mean, they're not going to go to zero. And Robin Hanson, in fact, in his paper, says that interest rates are actually going to be sky high in the future. That's what he says. So there's no evidence that I can see that just because we have this amazing technology, suddenly everyone's rent or mortgage is going to fall to zero. It's unclear to me that anytime soon healthcare costs are going to, fall dramatically. I mean, maybe sometime very far in the future, healthcare would become less expensive because of these technologies, I guess. But, the problem is that if you automate all the discretionary stuff, all the actual goods, all the services, all the things that we only spend a relatively small percentage of our revenue on, if those things all go to zero, we're still left with the other, 70-80% of our budget, which are relatively fixed costs. So the only way you can, if by eliminating those costs in terms of goods being produced, you're also going to eliminate everyone's income. I mean, this makes sense, right? Because your stuff is cheaper at Walmart, but you lose your whole income and you can't pay your mortgage or your rent. Then that implies that in order to get to an equilibrium situation, you have to have a massive deflation in asset values, right? Housing costs, housing values have to fall dramatically. Everyone has to default on their mortgage. And that probably implies basically the collapse of the financial system, right? So those are pretty big things to happen. I mean, so I'm not sure how you get through that to this world where no one has a job but everything is really cheap, so it's okay.
Yeah, it does seem like there's a gap. Something has to happen in the meantime, and
that would be cataclysmic. We have to acknowledge that. Look what happened last year. And what we're talking about here is, essentially you could, if you take this to the extreme, you're talking about a situation where no one would pay their mortgage.
Right.
I mean, people would walk away from it. People would say, I'm not going to have any income ever because I'm never going to get a job again. And they can't foreclose on everyone. They can't evict everyone. So why should I pay my mortgage? Why should I pay my rent? So then what happens to the whole system at that point?
Yeah, it would collapse, and it would fundamentally change, right? I mean, it would have to. Something, what it would be almost a singularity, right?
And it would be something that would, it's unclear that if that happened, property rights would be preserved, the rule of law would be preserved, the whole system would be preserved. So the point I want to try to make here is that the people who are most likely to be opposed to what I'm suggesting, people who are conservative, libertarian, they should understand what they're risking, right? If you if you just remain in denial and you say this is never going to happen, you know, I want to hold to a hard capitalist outlook, this is what you're risking. I think you could have a fundamental meltdown of everything, and we might end up with something totally new, and it is very possible that it would not be something to the liking of someone who is a libertarian.
Well, speaking of things that won't be to the liking of libertarians, let's talk a little bit about the compensation plan as described in your book, because it's not just a flat-out everybody gets a check for $500 every week or something like that. There actually are behavioral incentives built in. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, the basic idea is that, I mean, this is the first part I think libertarians would agree with, conservatives would agree with. The problem with welfare is that it does not create incentives, right? I mean, there is no incentive to improve yourself, no incentive to go and get training, to get education, to, you know, have a more fulfilling life, right? That's why welfare creates an underclass. And once you fall into that trap, you tend to get stuck there. I mean, conservatives would be the first ones to point that out. And what I'm saying is that we're going to have a system that looks a little bit like welfare, and that I would avoid calling it welfare in the future for potentially most people. So obviously if you do that without making some changes to it, then you essentially have the potential to destroy society. You'd have an entire society where no one basically bothers to go to school. Everyone just plays video games all day or whatever, or maybe in the future it will be virtual reality games or something, you know, something even more mesmerizing. I mean, you know, you could have a complete social breakdown. So the idea is that if you're going to provide people with an income, and if you have, and I'm saying you have to do that because you have no choice. You've got to give them an income. Then you should demand something in return, right? And obviously right now what we demand in return is that person go to work and do a traditional job, hopefully in the private sector. If in the future that becomes impossible, then we need to demand something else of them. And all I suggest in the book is that there should be a variety of incentives for people to do things that are positive for themselves and for society. And I think that the number one thing is to become educated, because if you remove the economic incentive for education, and I think that's something that could happen, you know, in the future, if people recognize that, you know, already right now we're seeing that people who go to college and graduate with a degree are seeing diminishing financial return from that. I mean, it's not as lucrative as it's been historically. It's becoming less and less. And that may well, you know, become more true in the future. And as that happens, you're going to see fewer people make the choice to go to college, fewer people willing to stick it out and graduate from high school. You've got to offer some sort of an incentive to keep those people doing that so that they continue to be educated, even if you're not going to utilize that education in a job. I mean, it's important for society, right? In order to have a civil society, in order to have a functional democracy, hopefully with people that are capable of, you know, understanding issues and making decisions and so forth, you need to have people that are educated. And if in the future people aren't going to work, then, you know, the primary incentive for education has always been, if I get educated, I can get a better job. If that's not going to be true in the future, you have to create another incentive, and that's you know, the primary thing I suggest in the book.
Martin, you know, we were talking just briefly about the Star Trek replicators and nanofactories and things like that, but there's an interim technology that we actually already have that's, you know, in its infancy, but getting better all the time, and that's 3D printers. Where, you know, basically I'd have something sitting on my desktop, I'd pour some goop in it, and it would print me out a coffee cup or whatever I want. I mean, do you see that as having any alleviating effect on this future you're projecting?
Why would that alleviate it? It seems to me that that's exactly the kind of automation I'm talking about. I mean,
Well, the reason it would alleviate is because I own the nanofactory. I mean, not the nanofactory. I own the 3D printer.
Oh.
All the wealth created by the 3D printer is for me. And if these printers are cheap enough that everybody can have one, and everybody can have them producing wealth for themselves in their own home, then it seems to me that that's, you know,
yeah.
I'm
very skeptical. Look, think about what you're saying. You're saying, first of all, you know, I'm going to go and buy a 3D printer and keep it for sort of a few years from now. My 3D printer is no longer leading edge, and
right.
with this thing, I'm going to produce products that are going to compete with, you know, General Motors, which also owns 3D printers and uses them. You know, individual people to own a cheap 3D printer are not going to be able to compete with larger enterprises that have access to even more advanced technology. I mean, there's always going to be differentiation between the cheapest personal technology and industrial scale technology. So in terms of what you can really produce with the thing, I doubt it would be competitive with what a huge corporation could produce. Secondly, I mean, you're assuming that every individual can produce something that a bunch of other people want to buy. I mean, some people.
You'd produce it only. If everybody has a 3D printer, why would somebody be interested in buying my coffee cup that I make in my 3D printer?
Right, you can all make your own.
I would make the coffee cup for myself to drink coffee out of.
That's right. So unless I mean, I don't know how exactly this thing is going to work unless there's some artistic input, right, where a particularly talented or creative individual can create something that other people can't create by using this thing, then some people could make an income that way, right?
Right, right.
But
yeah.
The idea that everyone could, including particularly unartistic or untalented people, I mean, is not workable at all. So that, I mean, it would be nice to have that.
I think where Stephen is taking us is back towards the Star Trek replicator where we produce our own stuff. But
right, but then
earlier,
still that still doesn't pay your rent or your mortgage, right?
You've still got the mortgage, you've still got the health care, you got okay. So
right.
I think we're at an impasse on that one.
Right.
We're not gonna solve that problem this evening. But I did want to say I like the enjoyed the book. I highly recommend it to all of our listeners, particularly our bristly conservative and libertarian listeners who are certain that this must be wrong. I think one of the things that really impressed me is Stephen, who politically I would definitely place in that camp, said that he found it, his response was somewhat bristly, but also that he had a hard time arguing with a good deal of the book. So I think that the issues that you raise are important, and that these are things that we are going to have to continue to look at. And I know we've got to jump to the end here quickly, but Martin, before you go, any last word on the subject?
Just that you know, I agree. I really hope people will read the book with an open mind. The main reason I wrote the book is to basically throw this idea out there. You know, I'd really like to have this idea discussed. I really feel that right now it's not on the radar. You know, I mean, if you look at what mainstream economists are saying, in particular about the current situation, this idea just does not get raised. I mean, you know, they're talking about the Federal Reserve and all that stuff, and that may be important, but this trend is very, very important as well, and it's something that we all need to start to focus on, I think.
All right. Well, that's the final word on the subject. Thank you very much for being with us, Martin. It was great talking with you.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Martin. It was great.
Thanks.
Okay, Stephen, what have we got going on music-wise this evening?
Okay, the song is Wake Up by Esteban.
Esteban, the famous Esteban. He's putting out free music now.
That's right.
We've got to go back. We've got to talk about the whole, how is free music going to impact the economy? Okay, so Wake Up by Esteban, and we've had a wake-up call this evening. Great discussion in the chat room. Thanks for everyone who listened live. Stephen, thanks for getting the music put together and for all your contributions. To everyone listening to us via MP3, and everyone who's part of the Fast Forward Family Radio family, join us next week when our special guest Cory Doctorow will continue our discussion of the new economy. And until then, live to see it.
Wake up. Wake up. Wake up. Devil's Night Fantasy. We were looking to deliver.
rush swelling. Feel the rush, feel the rush, feel the rush swelling. Feel the rush, feel the rush, feel the rush.